I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, January 31st. One of the people who attended New York City police officer Jason Rivera's funeral on Friday was New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and she had something more to say that day than "I'm sorry for your loss." The illegal firearm used to kill Rivera and Officer Wilbert Mora was trafficked from out of state. So Gillibrand used the tragic occasion later that day to push for a bill that maybe, just maybe, will get enough support to pass now, making illegal gun trafficking a federal crime. Hard to believe it isn't one already. We will ask why not. Other things on the Senate's agenda. I know this sounds like a 2021 rerun, but negotiate with Joe Manchin for a slimmer version of the Build Back Better bill. It could still matter to Democrats, don't forget, to their chances of keeping the majority in Congress in particular, if they have something real to show on paid family leave or universal pre-K or some of the other central provisions. Senator Gillibrand was one of those people talking to Manchin late last year. We'll see where this picks up. There's also Ukraine. Gillibrand is on the Armed Forces Committee with President Biden, talking about deploying troops to NATO countries nearby. We'll ask about that. And of course, it's the Senate that will have to confirm President Biden's pick to replace Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court. Biden has promised to nominate the court's first ever black woman from a list of many who are highly qualified. And this may come as a shock, but at least one Republican is now promising to vote for at least one of those on Biden's shortlist, federal judge Michelle Childs of South Carolina. Some of you know she is the favorite of Congressman Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, who's very close to Biden. And with an apparent vote to confirm waiting to be had from South Carolina's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
I can't think of a better person for President Biden to consider for the Supreme Court than Michelle Childs. She has wide support in our state. She's considered to be a fair-minded, highly gifted jurist. She's one of the most decent people I've ever met.
Lindsey Graham on CBS Face the Nation yesterday. Surprised? With that, we welcome New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Hi, Senator. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. Let's start with the Supreme Court, Senator. Do you support President Biden's pledge to nominate a black woman? And do you have a favorite from the names that are being discussed, or maybe even another one to add to the conversation?
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm very excited about the list of judges that President Biden has floated so far. They are extremely well qualified. They have a diverse range of experience. And I think it's really exciting for a lot of Americans to see this process move forward. I don't have a favorite. I've just begun to look at their credentials, and they all seem quite impressive to me. So I'm looking forward to when we see who he nominates, and then the hearings, and then the vote.
That clip of Senator Graham supporting Michelle Childs from his state, South Carolina, surprised?
You know, delightfully surprised. That's wonderful that he knows her and that he knows her experience and the support she has throughout her state. I think her background is very, very compelling, and hopefully she'll be considered along with the rest of them. But I think it was a very favorable thing for Senator Graham to do, and it also moves the country towards more bipartisanship and more a better working relationship. So I was very pleased to hear it.
And it could be part home state boosterism because Judge Childs is from his home state. Or I guess we should note that Graham does show bursts of occasional bipartisanship, or at least deference to whoever is president, on Supreme Court nominees. He did vote for Sonia Sotomayor, for example, which some other Republicans did not. Do you expect a contentious confirmation process necessarily? So often when a woman of color is up for something substantial, Republicans try to paint her as an angry radical.
You know, I'm optimistic. Among the people that he's suggesting, one is a D.C. circuit judge who already received three Republican votes in her circuit confirmation process. So at least two, therefore, have some bipartisan support already. And that, I think, bodes very well to a more substantive hearing as opposed to a political hearing.
That's Ketanji Brown Jackson, the judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, who's considered a very leading candidate, who, yes, did get some Republican votes when she was confirmed to that position. So it would be politically difficult, we assume, for them to turn around and then vote no on a judge they voted yes on. On the legislation to make illegal gun trafficking across state lines, to make it a federal crime, illegal gun trafficking, I guess I'm a little, you know, jaw-dropped when I read your press release on that, because illegal gun trafficking across state lines isn't already a federal crime?
You know, that's pretty shocking, Brian, that it's not. Right now, our officers and FBI do not have the authority to do these cross-border investigations, particularly, well, the FBI does, but the NYPD doesn't. Right now, if somebody brings a gun into New York City that isn't properly registered or, you know, wasn't bought properly, it's a paperwork violation. It's a misdemeanor. It's not a felony. And so what we want to do is create a felony out of those who are the straw purchasers, who traffic these guns, bring them straight up the iron pipeline, and sell them in the back of trucks, and just sell them directly to criminals, sell them directly to gang members. We know about different, I talked to the Bronx DA, and she told me about a case where a college student was trafficking weapons by just putting them on the bus. We've heard of other stories while they traffic weapons through Amtrak. Like the ease with which these criminals are bringing in firearms that are then used in crimes is shocking. And so we have this proposal that would basically criminalize this activity. A gun trafficker could face up to 20 years in prison and up to a $250,000 fine. It makes this entire process illegal, that you can't receive two or more firearms and bring them across state line if the recipient knows or has reason to know that the receipt is illegal. That's the core of this bill. And it can really take on the organizers and the trafficking rings, and they, the kingpins, can get up to 25 years in prison or 35 years if they're trafficking machine guns or if the gun has a firearm silencer or muffler. So this is the way to put teeth into law enforcement's toolbox so they can go out and find these traffic rings and find these smugglers. It'll make a difference and keep our city safer. 90% of the guns used in crime in New York City are from out of state. And so we know if you can stop this, you can save lives, particularly of the innocent young people who bullets are killing, just a stray bullet. And one of the reasons why we named this bill the Hadiya Pendleton and Nyasia Pryor Yard bill is after two young girls who lost their lives in that way. Hadiya Pendleton is from Chicago. Nyasia Pryor Yard was a young woman living in Brooklyn. I sat down with her mother last week just to talk about this bill and what we want to do to bring it forward. And I met with a bunch of the moms who are part of the moms movement who have lost. I met another mom who lost two sons. I mean, this is so constant. And, you know, when you meet a mom who's lost a four-year-old boy on a park bench when she's sitting there just spending time with her child, it's just, you can't recover from those moments. And so these moms are carrying the message of their children and their loved ones and lifting them up for us to remember that we deserve safety in our communities. We deserve to not have this random gun violence constantly plaguing every neighborhood. And it's something that I think this bill would help begin to protect our communities.
You say it would make a difference. Would it make a difference? I mean, skeptics might argue if illegal gun trafficking into New York is already a state crime, making it illegal under federal law, too, won't matter much to the availability of illegal guns, because they're already flouting the law in that respect. So is it more than symbolic?
It's much more than symbolic, because if you just arrest an individual who shot a gun and someone died, you just can maybe convict him of using an illegal firearm. But what's happening is there are these criminal networks and gangs and and trafficking rings that are bringing up hundreds of guns purposefully, so it's easier for a criminal to buy a gun in New York despite all our strong gun safety rules. I mean, we have background checks, we have lots of strong rules, but this trafficking subverts all of them. There's no opportunity for a background check if you're just having a criminal sell a gun to another criminal. And if they're just pouring into the state through the Iron Pipeline, you need to go after the kingpins. You need to go after the people that are taking these guns from, you know, the 1% of bad gun dealers out there that just know that this is going straight up to New York, straight into criminal markets. They have to be put in jail too. And so that's why this is necessary, because NYPD doesn't have the authority to cross state lines. They can't do the investigation and find out who brought the guns. And then this gives more tools to them and to the FBI to really crack down and put these kingpins in jail.
Mark in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me. I know that you're on the Armed Services Committee, Senator, and to that end, I ask this. You know, so often we think that it's the munitions industry, the aerospace industry, that encourages our Congress folks to keep these crazy wars going on and on. You being in such a position, I'd love to hear your feedback in that regard, particularly as we look at Ukraine, a neighboring country to the Soviet, to Russia. We here in our hemisphere, when the Cuban thing happened, we didn't want these folks in our backyard or Venezuela. We wouldn't accept that. So what justifications do you see for the Congress, for the government as a whole, to keep building up these military budgets?
Mark, thank you very much. So on military budgets, Senator, and also on the troop deployment to NATO countries nearest to Russia.
You know, I appreciate the caller's perspective because, you know, we've heard this over many, many years, like beware of the military-industrial complex, beware of outsider institutions trying to get Congress to spend more and more money on war funding to increase the likelihood of war. And the good news is, there's many of us in Congress who are working on war powers reform, making sure wars can only be declared through Congress, not through executive action, to make sure that when we do have to be in that position that we know what our exit strategy is, we know who we're fighting, in what country, for what length of time, so we don't get into these forever wars ever again. I think that was why, for President Biden, it was one of his priorities that it was time to draw down our presence in Afghanistan and to end that war. But with regard to the specific question of Ukraine, there is a huge push in Congress right now to solve this diplomatically. There is not the support to rush to another war or to engage in military action if it is not absolutely necessary. And there's a long way to go before this would be absolutely necessary. And that means we should be working on a multilateral basis with our allies right now to talk about sanctions, to talk about other pressure on Russia to make sure they do not invade Ukraine and continue to destabilize the region. There is a lot of support in the Senate to make sure that we have a robust sanctions bill ready. There's several of us have already supported a bill by Senator Menendez to have those sanctions ready should Russia make a move that is contrary to peace in that region. And so we are not eager to engage in another war or in unnecessary military action. It doesn't mean we don't stand ready to protect this country, to protect our values, and to protect our allies should it be necessary. But right now, there is not a call to war. I can assure you, within the Congress, it is a call to aggressive diplomacy and using sanctions and other tools that we have to create a peaceful resolution. I do understand the caller's perspective and about what pressures Congress might be under at any given time. But right now, there is a lot of support for alternative efforts against Russia.
Tyson in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hello, Tyson.
Hello, Brian.
Go ahead,
How are
Tyson.
You?
I'm okay, thank you. You have a question for the senator?
I'm really upset that the Democrats aren't strong-arming Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema to get with the program, because too many have fought and died for voting rights in this country. And for them to be prima donnas and continue to grab unwanted spotlights is just unacceptable. And I also would like to see Anita Hill put forward as a Supreme Court nominee.
Tyson, thank you very much. So on voting rights, Senator, we know the filibuster seems like it will remain for voting rights legislation because of Manchin and Sinema. But as recently as 2006, the Senate voted 98-0 to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, including the Justice Department oversight of many southern states that had histories of racist voter suppression. And some of the same states appear to be at it again. But this time you would get zero Republican votes for a voting rights bill, apparently, and two fewer Democrats than you need, Manchin and Sinema, for overturning the filibuster to go ahead on this with just 51. So what do you want to say to the caller or anyone on this?
Well, I want to thank the caller for his advocacy and interest. You know, it was very disappointing. We all were hoping we could get to a place where we could have common ground on using this filibuster reform to include a vote on the Voting Rights Act and the specific bills that Senator Manchin negotiated that were most of the John Lewis bill, not all of it, but most of it. And we didn't get there, and that's just the realities of electoral politics. We only have 50 Democrats. They don't all have the same views on all issues, and we weren't able to win them over on the merits of filibuster reform for this vote. It doesn't mean the issue's dead. It doesn't mean we won't get to vote on it again. It doesn't mean it's not going to come up next year or the year after. It just means this one effort, we were unable to move forward. I do believe that voting rights is essential. What's happening in these Republican states, red states where they have very Republican and very conservative governors and legislatures, they are upending people's rights to vote. They are making it harder for people of color to vote. They are making different demographics harder to vote. In a place like New Hampshire, they don't want the students to vote. There's so many efforts to unwind people's rights to vote, and it would have been better if we could have protected them in this moment in time, but we could not. So it's not about going after any individual members of the Senate. We are all colleagues, and we respect one another, and it would not be effective. What's effective is to continue to advocate on the merits and winning larger majorities so that you can have more diversity of view and still be successful in getting a vote. The Democratic Party keeps a majority because it has a diversity of views. You have to be able to elect Democrats in very red and very purple places, and they're not always going to share all the views of a New Yorker, which is understandable. We have a very progressive view of the world, and we have a certain view about what our elected leaders should do, and that's not going to be the same in other states. So I know you're disappointed. I'm deeply disappointed, but it doesn't mean we're not going to stop fighting. We're never going to give up. We're going to keep pushing forward, and we will get another vote at some point in time, and by then maybe we will have been more persuasive. So don't lose hope, and I think the next focus that we're going to have is trying to build the coalition for the Build Back Better legislation. And I think we'll get there. I think there's a lot in this bill that Senator Manchin supports. He definitely supports parts of affordable daycare. He supports universal pre-K. He supports green energy investments, energy efficiency investments. He supports affordable housing. He supports lowering drug prices. So these are the areas where we're trying to create relief for the economy, for individual families, to lower the costs of housing and daycare and drugs and medicine. So these are shared goals and values. And we were very close to getting to yes a month ago. So we just need to go back to where we were in common ground, build from there, and get it done. And I believe that will happen. So when we do that, then we can, continue to talk to the American public about how we are going to continue to help the economy grow through these very meaningful reforms, along with all the infrastructure investments. We will get this economy up and running. People will be working. They'll have access to better health care, and they'll have access to stronger jobs and better income. So that's what we're working on, and I do have faith, and don't lose faith. Everyone is different. They have different priorities, but it doesn't mean we can't have common ground.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand our monthly Call Your Senator segment. We always appreciate it, Senator. Talk to you next month.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.